When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I always liked licensed games. I love licensed games so
Why
much.
Why is that?
I think it's possibly when somebody says to you, you go into a cantina and you're playing Star Wars, you mentally, you know what a cantina looks like.
Right.
And yet if it's a homebrew fantasy game, you say you go into a tavern, I'm just like, well, what's it look like? What are the people like? What's there? So yeah, I think it's just my mental shorthand.
Welcome to Tabletop Talk, a podcast where I talk to creatives in tabletop gaming about more than what they make. I focus on how and why they create. You're in the right place if you find the creative and design process interesting. This is an interview with David Chapman, the creator behind RPG's Conspiracy X 2.0, Doctor Who, and Wild. We talk about his favorite doctors, how he ended up calling different U.S. government departments and asking about the department structure, and his feelings about tarot cards. This recording was made months ago, and the Laundry role-playing game 2nd Edition is now live on Kickstarter at the time of this episode's drop. The game is based on the Laundry novels by Charles Stross, and David is the game's producer. And I backed it, shocker, immediately. The link to the campaign is in the show notes. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with David.
This is Lee.
And this is Pat.
And we're Diesel Shot. And when we're not making games, you will find us listening to Tabletop Talk. And fucking up the tape.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Today I'm chatting with writer, any winning designer, creator of the Vortex system, editor, and the founder of RPG A Day, David F. Chapman. Now, David was on episode 206 to talk about RPG A Day, and he's been kind enough to come back to talk about Conspiracy X 2.0, Doctor Who, and Wild. David, welcome back to the third floor.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
So, David, when we had you on with Anthony, you got the standard question, which I always ask people that are new to the podcast, which is, you know, how did you find tabletop gaming? And people can go back to episode 206 to hear your fascinating origin story. But since then, you and I have chatted and talked, and I've not only did we learn what a huge X-Files fan you are, but obviously a big Doctor Who fan. So I'm going to now ask you the standard Doctor Who fan question.
Oh, blimey.
Which is, who are your favorite doctors and why?
Okay. I think top of the list would definitely be Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's just because he's Northern and it's got that accent as well. So I empathized quite a lot with that. And I think it was just kind of a perfect return for the series. I just thought he was brilliant.
So what did you think he brought? Because that was a huge moment when we think about it, right? Like the series was coming back, the first new Doctor Who we've had in decades, it felt like, at that point. And you know, he was a very different doctor as well, but I agree. I thought he, you know, blew it out of the water. He's not one of my favorite doctors, but I am completely aligned with everything you say. So I'm trying to get a sense, like, and maybe this is a better question, David, is how do you judge this, right? Is it just who they are and they connect with you? Because, you know, it's all the same doctor in the lore, even though they're different actors, different writers.
What is it? Maybe we can figure this out with Eccleston. What was it that made him the Doctor for you?
I think he managed to perfectly capture that playful wistfulness, but had that underlying anger and the kind of I don't know, it's almost the just shock of being through the Time War. He just managed to capture all that really well. He could flip from being so quippy and and hilarious at 1 second right down into shouting annoyance and frustration at how the universe was in the next moment as well. He was just so good.
Yeah, he brought a really unique intensity, which it took me a little off guard. But it's funny because I go back and watch the Doctors I grew up with, and that intensity was there too. I don't know. I just remember the quippiness. I remember the laughs and the fun. But I mean, the idea of there being serious dark sides to the Doctor wasn't new. But I felt like Eccleston brought it out. All right, so Eccleston, we've got Eccleston number one.
Mm-hmm.
Who's okay, next?
Next will probably be Matt Smith.
Oh, God bless you. I loved him. And what did Matt bring?
It was just the complete random bonkersness of everything, really. He had the dark side as well. He had the gravitas when he needed it, but he was just hilarious and just had some of the best lines ever. Some of his stories kind of let him down, but
yes.
Yeah, he was just great. That I always have this this is kind of wibbly wobbly timey wimey because jumping forward in the conversation to when Matt Smith was first announced, I managed to read the scripts for series 5 before they'd aired.
Oh wow.
And there was a line in The Beast Below that was in the script that never made it onto screen that I always thought was perfectly summed up Matt Smith. And Amy asks him what it must be like in his head. And he basically says, it's a roller coaster full of geniuses going, wee.
What a great line. Oh my God. I can't believe that didn't make it. Cause that does capture it, doesn't it? Was there a Doctor for you that you ended up growing to like, that maybe in the first couple episodes, and this could be original series or the return series, was there a Doctor that made a comeback for you that at first you're like, but you ended up falling in love with?
Yeah, probably Tom Baker, actually.
Interesting. So he's my Doctor.
Yeah.
That's who I grew up with.
See, when I watched Tom when he was first on, because I'm ancient. Because my mother introduced me to Doctor Who with John Pertwee, and Invasion of the Dinosaurs was the first I saw of those. And then when Tom started, the legendary Hinchcliffe and Holmes era started, it got too scary for me. And I,
interesting,
as a kid,
yeah,
I stopped watching it. That was too scary for me at all. I had like the, I think it was the 1977 annual or something. Even some of the images in that was too scary for me. So Tom was out the window for me, and I didn't return to watching it until the whole Logopolis era and him regenerating. And yeah, it was just too scary. And then a friend of mine was a big Doctor Who fan at school and bought all the VHS tapes as they came out and introduced me to City of Death, which is my favorite classic, really.
Yeah.
I love City of Death, mostly because of the Douglas Adams connection as well. I think the scripting on that is so spot on. It's just great.
As I hear you talking about it, it's funny how different our experiences are because of where we grew up. Right. I mean, Doctor Who was an integral part of BBC television growing up. We knew nothing about it here in the States. And then, let me see, I would have been like 10-ish or 12-ish. So that's 40 years ago. That's when PBS, the public broadcasting station here, started carrying Doctor Who. So the first Who that was covered by PBS was Baker. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching it going, what in God's name am I watching right now? Because we had no introduction to it, right? It was just, here's Doctor Who. And you know, they just started playing them. And it took me a while as a kid to just really wrap my head around the entire thing, let alone when they changed doctors, right? And I saw that there was other doctors as well. And we had no like on-ramp whatsoever. But I think what's key for me was I couldn't stop watching, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so even though I may not completely understand what was going on, I had to keep watching. The other thing that I think is fascinating, this is a testament to when it came back and the actors and the people, Moffat and everybody that was involved in bringing it back. In a million years, I never, ever would have guessed that my wife would like Doctor Who. Never. like she is, doesn't like fantasy. She doesn't like sci-fi. She doesn't like horror. Like, this is so outside of her wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. I was watching Tenet.
Oh yeah.
His run. And my wife was like, what's going on here? And I'm like, this is Doctor Who, honey. She's like, I've heard of Doctor Who. And she just got sucked into it. And now she is a huge fan, fan of Doctor Who. And we watched together. It helps that her hall pass is David Tennant, but which I'm okay with because he can do no wrong. I find him attractive, but oh, that's fantastic. So David, I guess, you know, I want to skip ahead of just a little bit, but then we're going to go backwards. How would you measure your Doctor Who knowledge before you started working on the game? So let's put you at 100 after working on the game. Where were you before working on the game from 0 to 100?
I'd probably been about the 50s or 60s.
Oh, really? Wow. So you almost doubled your knowledge of Doctor Who by working on the game.
Yeah. As I said, a friend of mine was really into it at school and used to make me watch the VHSs that he bought. And so when it got to our sixth form, when we were sort of about 16, 17, we used to have some free periods in school. We used to go to our nearest mate's house and end up watching Tomb of the Cybermen or stuff like that. So I was aware of it. And I got very into it during the Peter Davison run, and then kind of slipped out and went back into it when with Sylvester. So I was a bit of a fan. And then I ended up working in a very large bookstore, which had a Dalek in it.
No kidding.
Full size Dalek. We used to be able to control
this is the kid that was afraid of the Tom Baker Doctor Who. And now you got a Dalek in the place where you work.
Well, he had control over the speech of it behind the counter. So he used to make it.
No do kidding. Things.
Oh, dear Lord, there's somebody at my front door. I'm sorry.
That's great. Go ahead. I'll wait for you. Go check on him. You're good.
That's all right. The wife's getting it.
Oh, bless her. So you could control what the Dalek said from behind the counter at the bookstore?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And scare the bejesus out of the kids.
But that's amazing. Really
nice bit in sort of the mid 2000s, just as it got to about 2004 and used to see all these kids coming in. And there was this Dalek at the bottom of the stairs in the bookshop and all these kids going, what's that? And then within a year, and wow. Eccleston coming on and it being on TV, the kids just knew exactly what it was and loved it. So it was a really nice thing to watch.
I bet. Like that. Yeah. Like when you think about it, of course they would have no idea, right? what or who that is, because they're not old like you and I.
I was going to say, and then of course I ended up working in a bookshop, in a shop that specialized in Doctor Who merchandise. So my Doctor Who knowledge kind of leapt up there.
You were faded.
And we had signings from a lot of the actors as well. I had Tom Baker was in a couple of times. We had Nicholas Courtney. We had to salute every time he was in because Brigadier. we had lots of the actors in, and yeah, it was very handy for while I was writing Who.
So for those of us in the States, how would you compare the original series and how ingrained it was in British entertainment and in British culture compared to this new run? Is it as popular now as it was back then, or is it different? Does my question make sense? I'm trying to get a sense because I know it was a huge part of British entertainment culture back in the original run, but I don't have a sense of it now.
It's been a bit of a roller coaster, a bit like the original run, because the popularity went up and down depending on who was in charge of it and depending on who the actor was.
Right.
And then of course the BBC kind of moved it around in the schedule. So instead of it being peak time, dinner time, Saturday night, it got moved to midweek at the same time as one of our biggest soaps, Coronation Street. So the ratings kind of dropped and then it got cancelled. And then we had the movie. And then since it's come back, I think it's just grown again. But it has had some dips. Sort of the end, the tail end of Peter Capaldi's era was a bit the ratings were kind of dropping again. And of course, we won't mention the man babies when Jodie took over, because Jodie was so good. She was fantastic.
And I loved her.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved her. And I just wished her writing was better. And you can't blame her for that, because that is really the only shortcoming to her run, is I felt like the writing just wasn't as strong. But yeah, Man Babies is the perfect example. Fragile little boys in grown ass man's bodies. So Capaldi for me was my grow to love.
Mm. Now I can see that.
In his defense, he was following up a doctor that just changed how I looked at everything. Right. And I remember about halfway through that first season, I remember turning to my wife and I'm like, I'm not feeling this. Mm. And she was the same. She's like, and then I think it was the second season of him that we really started to see the layers that he was bringing to it. And he became one of my favorites. And I think more than any of the other doctors, and I never would have guessed this, my heart broke a little bit on his last episode. Like
his last series was so good.
So good.
Yeah.
And it was also neat to watch a companion breach across two doctors that way. Mm-hmm. And the way the relationship was handled by Smith and handled by him and the writing on that, just fantastic stuff. God, this could be a podcast about Doctor Who. I haven't talked about Doctor Who in so long. So guys, the Insider Insight series allows me to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and the methods for crafting their creations. That's what we're going to do with David today. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Conspiracy X 2.0. We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Zoe, co-host of the Maniculum podcast, here to tell you about our new Kickstarter project launching June 1st of this year. The Marginal Worlds Kickstarter is a deck of 50 easy-to-play magic items pulled directly from medieval manuscripts that you can play in any TTRPG. So if you're looking to dazzle your players with magic items once hidden for centuries in ancient tomes, sign up on Kickstarter or themaniculumpodcast.com to check out sample cards, playtest them yourself, and bring the magic to your table on June 1st.
So guys, I we're only going to talk about three games. David was kind enough to narrow down his huge body of work down to just three games. And the first one we want to talk about is a game, honestly, that I'm not very familiar with. It's Conspiracy X 2.0. And I'm going to read the blurb off the website for it. And then I'm going to just interrogate David about this, because as soon as I started studying up for this, I went down a rabbit hole and I'm like, holy crap, how am I not familiar with this game? So Conspiracy X takes place in a world of dark secrets and hidden agendas, where the only certainty is nothing is what it seems. The president may not be human, and the sign carrying paranoid on the street corner, ranting about the CIA mind control satellites might very well be right. In other words, it's a world just like yours. If you could only see beyond the lies. So great premise. And for someone who loves X-Files, this game just must speak to you. Where does the beginnings of this game start?
That's a really strange tale, because I went to art college, to university. I came out of that and I started my own comics publishing company. Just a little one, doing little indie things. I kind of got to the end of what I was working on, and I was kind of looking for other things. And a friend of ours at our local video store, hi Jason, knew that I was a massive X-Files fan.
Right.
And he said to me, "Oh, you've got to check out this RPG." I'd not heard of Conspiracy X really before that. So he loaned me a copy of the first edition core rulebook. And I read it all and just thought, oh, this is great. I love this. And I emailed Eden Studios, because it was Eden by then rather than New Millennium Entertainment, who originally published it. And I emailed George Vasilikos and Alex Jerkat at Eden and said, I want to write and draw a comic based on Conspiracy X. Would this be okay?
Gotcha. So you reached out for the IP, not to get involved with the game. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Nah. And they said, yeah, sure. Of course. It's like, do what you like. As far as they're concerned, it was publicity for Conspiracy X.
Sure.
And so I started sort of doing some doodles and things like that. And this was just as the indie comic scene was kind of flagging, and I closed the comic publishing business and
real quick, David, what caused that to fly? Because I do remember this. I remember when indie comics had really had some steam behind it and had really kind of had its moment, but I never got a sense of why it waned. Do you have a sense of that, having been involved there?
I really don't know. This was sort of, I got into the comic publishing sort of 98. And back then there was a real emphasis on cool creator-owned black and white indies.
Right.
And that they were becoming more popular than Marvel and DC.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of about early 2000s, it's almost like everybody kind of went, the little indies, look at the big guys, and went straight back to Marvel and DC, and they became huge again. And it was just at this point where I thought, oh, well, I'm struggling to do anything really anyway. So, but I'd already developed quite a nice internet rapport with George and Alex at Eden Studios. And it kind of flashed back to my earlier attempts at a RPG writing career back in the late 80s when I wanted to write Ghostbusters. So I just said to myself, I wouldn't mind writing some RPG stuff for you. And they said, sure, we'll just prove that you can write. So I went away and wrote an entire supplement for All Flesh Must Be Eaten that never has seen light of day. It was called Summer Camp Stalkers and Unstoppable Evil, which basically turned the zombie horror stuff into like a slasher movie.
Beautiful.
And I remember George looking at it, and he emailed me back and said, yeah, okay, but let's start you off with this instead. And he'd just got the text in for Terra Primate from a writer, I think it's Al Bruno. He'd written all the setting and how the Terra Primate things worked, but it didn't have the rule system plugged into it, and they wanted to just plug in Unisystem from that they were using for Flesh Must Be Eaten and Witchcraft. So they said, oh, do you want to have a go at this? So I kind of merged the two together and made it into a book.
And where does your ability to, because I mean, I understand your background enough to get a sense of where you get off being a writer, right? I mean, I understand your experience with writing, but getting involved with RPG mechanics, where does that come from? Where did you feel comfortable being able to lift the hood that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I quite liked tinkering with games anyway. The game I was running started as, at that time, it was a mage game. And then I converted all the characters and the setting over into cult. And then converted it again into witchcraft, because that was the game I was playing at the moment. So I was getting quite used to how Unisystem worked, but kind of being dumped with why don't you just merge these two bits together for Total Primate? It was a bit daunting, but they just kind of left me to it. No deadlines or anything like that. Just do it. So I managed to get that done. I did some writing and editing work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and All Flesh Must Be Eaten as well. And while I was tinkering with all that, my mind was constantly thinking of Conspiracy X, which was the one game that Eden Studios had that didn't use Unisystem. Right. It had its own system that you either loved or hated. It was sometimes a little complicated, but people who'd got to grips with it loved it and were very passionate about it.
And what did they love, other than obviously there's a crunchiness to it, but was there some other aspect of the original rule set that people fell in love with?
I don't know. There were some bits in there that were perfect for the setting, like the pulling strings bit. Where you have a list of contacts and resources that you can kind of manipulate behind the scenes to try and get information and things like that. So that made it into a new one. But because it wasn't Unisystem, I kind of approached them and just said, you know, why don't you convert it? I wouldn't mind having a go. And I remember having a meeting with George when he was over in London for Gen Con UK. I think it was the last Gen Con UK we had. And we just sort of met up with him there and just tried to convince him that it was a good idea. And thankfully he said yes. So the 11, 12 books of Conspiracy X became four little hardcovers.
That's incredible. It's one thing to say, wouldn't this be great? Another thing to be told, go for it. And then it's a whole nother thing to do it. How hard was that? Once you got the yes and you're like, oh no, was it harder than you thought? Or were there aspects of it that you didn't anticipate that were hard?
It was an odd one. Cause I remember I signed the contracts with Eden. And that was a week after my father died.
Oh boy.
And I kind of used Conspiracy X as a way to sort of get away from the world, basically.
Yep, to work through it, sure.
I buried myself in the work, and kind of just sat there chugging away at the computer. And then I initially approached it thinking, oh, this is going to be just like Terra Primate. It's just take out the rules of Conspiracy X, plug in Unisystem, everything will be fine. And then I did some research, and then I realized that after 9/11, the way that the American Justice Department's and the structure of the American government completely changed due to the Department of Homeland Security. So I had to do some more research, completely rejig how the government departments appeared in the game. And I was basically emailing the Department of Homeland Security and just saying, hey, could you just sort of clarify this? And it's like, I'm sure I'm on a database there somewhere.
I bet.
this weirdo keeps emailing us.
He wants an org chart.
So CTU from 24, does that exist? And the email emails me back and going, no, it doesn't. Stop bothering me.
I never would have thought of this. That's fascinating to me. So you had to restructure because of reality, which you're not writing, right? You're writing a fantasy based off of reality. But when the reality changes, in order for it to be at all relevant for players, you have to restructure it. what did you have, like, what did you have to figure out, right? So what were the new challenges with this new government structure that you had to layer on top of this conspiracy?
Thankfully, it wasn't too much. It was mostly where people's jurisdiction was. It was like, if I remember rightly, customs moved from Treasury to Homeland Security, and alcohol, tobacco, and firearms moved from one branch to another. It was, it's like, being a Brit, it was like, what is all this?
we don't understand it, and we live here. So don't stress about that. And this is my ignorance of the game, so excuse the question, but I bet there's people listening that might be wondering the same thing. How much of the conspiracy aspect of Conspiracy X is canon lore, and how much is left up to the table? So I get the premise, right? Which is everything is a lie. Things don't work the way you think they work. How much does the table get to figure to determine what that is versus to uncover it? Does that make sense?
There's a lot of uncovering. There's not much player input to what the conspiracy is.
Got it.
And that's kind of what drew me to Conspiracy X, is that the background for it was so perfectly defined. It was all his, when Roswell happened and the first contact with the Greys, the Majestic 12 influence there, the split of the government into two major conspiracies, which is Aegis, who the player characters work for, and the Black Book, who are the bad guys, who are the National Defense Directorate. And then you've on top of the Greys, you've got Atlanteans, and then you've got the reptiles, the lizard folk, who were basically the ones that were very Doctor Who-esque again. They were on the planet before us. They thought something bad was going to happen, just like the Silurians in Doctor Who. But instead of going underground, they all got in spaceships and flew off and then came back thinking, oh, yeah, we'll just go home. It's all fine. except all these pesky monkey people have taken over.
Incredible. You've obviously played a lot and ran several Conspiracy X games. One of the things that I would love to hear is, are there certain moments in play that you remember fondly? So moments where you felt like this is the game, this is where the game is shining right now. I'd love to hear that, to get maybe some sample moments.
I play tested it a couple of times. Not really been a player in it, but I've been a GM a few times. I do remember thinking that it was incredibly dangerous. It's the moment the Greys turn up, then it gets really nasty.
Yeah.
Because they could just whittle everything and make things move about. And then there's another element in Conspiracy X, which was trying to basically replicate the Monster of the Week episodes from X-Files.
Right.
So there's people get corrupted by the amount of psychic energy that's on the planet and turn into folklore monsters. So that's how you end up with the werewolves and the vampires and all that kind of shenanigans. But they're pretty darn lethal as well. And yeah, I do have distinct memories of the couple of playtest sessions where it's just innocent guys in suits running around with pistols expecting something quite normal. And then, oh yeah, it really does go
go sideways on them really fast. So David, as you were doing the playtesting for 2.0, can you think of something that came out of the playtest process that made it into the game? So something that we wouldn't have in the game today had the playtest not happened?
Blimey. I do remember there was a very specific rule that I realized I'd missed out. And I honestly can't remember what it is, but there was a moment in the play when I just remember thinking, nope, stop everything. I'm going to have to write this down.
Yeah.
we just stopped for like 10-15 minutes while I made massive notes and then went back and drafted it all up. And if it wasn't for that game, there'd be a terrible gap in there.
Isn't that something? The entire playtest process is absolutely fascinating for me. So now I need you to help us build a bridge, David. So you're working with Ian Studios. You've gone from, I want to do a comic based off of this, to I start working at some of their other games, to, hey, how about 2.0? And that comes to fruition. You make that happen. What's the bridge from here to Doctor Who?
That's a really strange one as well. Okay. So Conspiracy X, the core book, comes out 2.0. And, you know, that's all right. I get a couple of emails every now and then from people saying, oh, this is pretty good. And then I get this email from somebody I've never heard of before, who is somebody that you've interviewed, Chris Birch.
Oh, yeah.
Back when he was still running Joystick Junkies and doing the T-shirts and video games and things like that. And he drops me an email and just said, oh, I really liked Conspiracy X. And we started chatting on the emails. And we started discussing how we wanted to get more people into role-playing and how do you get a new generation of kids playing RPGs? And we both kind of discussed and just sort of went, yeah, what I always liked licensed games. I love licensed games so
much.
Why
is that?
I think it's possibly when somebody says to you, you go into a cantina and you're playing Star Wars, you mentally, you know what a cantina looks like.
Right.
And yet if it's a homebrew fantasy game, you say you go into a tavern, I'm just like, well, what's it look like? What are the people like? What's there? So yeah, I think it's just my mental shorthand.
Well, and a lot of the work is done, right? With a licensed game, the world is built out and there's a familiarity for the table when they sit down, but that's a reason why some people hate playing licensed games is they feel that constraint, but you don't, you find it as an asset.
I love it. Absolutely love it. And my earliest favorite games were like West End games, Star Wars, and Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters is the reason why I started writing. So I was chatting to Chris Birch and we're basically just saying, what you need is a license that the kids are into that we could possibly try getting. And we'll see what happens. And I'd say, oh yeah, it will need to be something cool. Like, I don't know, James Bond or Doctor Who. Cause we'd just got to the point when, Christopher Eccleston's series had finished and that massive two-parter with all the Daleks. And
oh, yeah.
It was like, oh my God, this is so good. This would work so well. And we were chatting about that on email and Chris Birch basically just said to me, well, actually I've worked with the BBC in the past and know the guy who's the head of BBC Worldwide Licensing. I'll see what I can do.
Chris is such a funny character.
And he disappears off. And
yeah.
About a week later, I get an email from him and he just says, I've been chatting with some other people and I think we should go for it. Let me introduce you to Dominic McDowell and Angus Abranson, who had just started Cubicle 7. They were like working out of a bedroom somewhere and then just started working on Slay Industries.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hadn't really published an awful lot. They were just getting their start. And then I ended up sitting in a pub in London chatting to these people. I'd met Angus a few times through the Camarilla because he was sheriff of London, if I remember rightly, for vampire LARPing. Whereas I was second in command of Clan Tremere in the UK somewhere, if I remember rightly, which is...
I didn't realize I was talking to a celebrity, Dave.
Nerd, here we go. So I kind of knew Angus anyway, and we were sitting in this pub, just sort of discussing what we should do and how we should approach the BBC about it. And
what was the initial game plan, David? What came out of that discussion? How did you guys decide to go to do the approach?
The main thing we wanted to do was to com- completely blow them away with what we could do.
Okay.
And show them exactly what we meant.
Interesting. Off. And how did you plan on doing that?
We teamed up with Fred Hicks from Evil Hat, who did our graphic design for us. And I wrote the first chapter of the RPG as if it was going to come out. And we put together a business plan type. This is the products we want to do. Here's what role-playing games are. And we laid it out in a book. Fred did the graphic design for it, made it look all really nice and shiny.
Yeah.
And we printed about 10 copies.
No kidding. So for those of you not in the room with me right now, he's reaching behind him and he's grabbed. Look at that. So cool.
This was our initial pitch and it's only like 30 pages.
Right.
We got it printed to explain what we wanted to do.
And yeah.
We sent this to the BBC and just said, this is what we want to do. What do you think? And about a month later, we'd been called into BBC Worldwide to have a chat. So we kind of went in. And Dom always relates this story whenever he's interviewed about this, saying that we went in not expecting to get anywhere with it.
Right.
We just kind of went in thinking, this will be a learning experience for us. This is how it actually works. We're never going to get this ever. So we kind of walked in, we showed them the proposal, and I had a little briefcase with me. We're all in suits. And the BBC just said, this is really nicely presented. I've never seen anything like this before, which confused us because we'd always heard that this was one of the holy grails of RPGs that people had tried in the past and hadn't got anywhere with
it. Yeah.
But apparently they just hadn't talked to the right person who was the one who was in charge.
Did you get a sense of why it clicked for them? So, did they expose to you why you were able to grab the brass ring here? Like, what was different?
I don't know. I think we were just really keen. We wanted to make something that was accessible to kids as well as adults. And I think Doctor Who was still quite new to this licensing for them because it was after so long away.
Right.
They were just like, oh, we'll make toys and stuff and it'll be cool. So we did this little meeting. I took with me a copy of the Buffy RPG from Eden and just said, this is what we want to do, just like this. And he had a flip through the Buffy RPG and said, yeah, this looks great, except you can't do it. Because it's a book. And
I don't understand.
Books that are published regarding Doctor Who have to be through BBC Books and Random House.
Oh, wow.
And so we kind of went, oh, okay. Oh, well, that's a bit of a downer.
Luckily, yeah.
In my briefcase, this is a weird one. In my briefcase, I had another example. I had West End Games' Xena and Hercules RPG. Which is a bit of an odd one, but I just picked it up off the shelf and thought, I can use this. And it's the box set that comes with a couple of books and some dice.
Interesting.
And the BBC looked at that and just said, if you do it as a box set like that, with dice in it, it's a game, not a book.
Isn't that fascinating?
You can publish it. Which is why the first couple of editions and the first couple of first supplement was a box set.
Wow.
And
so how did you eventually, because books, you guys ended up making books, though. How did you end up being able to go from the box set to the books?
I think there was a bit of negotiations and also clarifications that we weren't making, like either a reference book that was for the public or a fiction book.
And
we were sort of somewhere in that weird limbo in between doing RPGs.
So it's still a game, right? Yep.
But yeah, so I think that's how we managed to get around it that way.
I try to imagine myself in your position, and it's a good thing I wasn't because I would have not gotten the license. But you know, when I think about, and I think about this with Buffy too, it's one thing to go, what a great world, what a rich amount of lore to work from. But I don't know how I would tackle, like, how do you play in this world, right? Because that's the next big thing. So how did you guys sort through that? Like, how does somebody play Doctor Who? And I think you understand what I mean, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like how do you approach that to say, okay, we've got established characters, established lore, established timelines here. Where do we inject the table?
It's a heck of a daunting thing.
And, I bet.
And I had the thing where we came out of the meeting thinking we hadn't got it, but we had, and then I didn't hear anything else. Angus and Don did the business end of things. Chris was still doing stuff for Cubicle 7 with doing the Star Blazer RPG. And basically, I just got this email from Dom and Angus saying, well, we've got the license, go write it. And that was it. There was, so if you can get it done by the end of the summer, that'd be good. And there was no real concrete deadline or anything like that. It was just, you go write it, here's a contract.
So what did you do next?
I think it was kind of, the key to it was trying to replicate what's seen on TV.
Okay.
Quite a lot of it was inspired by Buffy, because Buffy had got this great way of balancing normal people and one superpowered character.
Right.
Which is basically the same as Doctor Who. You've got loads of ordinary people who eat chips and work in shops. And then you've got a time traveling 900-year-old genius.
Right.
So Buffy kind of influenced that quite a lot. And then the tricky bit was going to be how to replicate insta kills, because Doctor Who, as you're watching the TV, it's just glowing blue skeleton, you're dead. How you can do that in a game without it being, oh God, I'm going to have to roll a new character every 5 minutes. And also to try and replicate the way that the Doctor manages to stop conflict.
Oh, that's super. All right. I want to dig into each one of these. So let's start with how you tackle the issue of character imbalance, right? So you had Buffy as a starting point. How did you end up solving that problem?
The thing is going to be story points.
Okay. And what are those?
They're basically the same as hero points, drama points, and things like that. Bennies that you have in most games. The ordinary characters have more than the superpowered one to kind of try and balance things out. And it means that they can spend these story points to do more heroic things and put themselves into more danger. And also it acts as a currency for the GM as well. So that which kind of influences the way that you try kind of replicate the TV series. Because if you're running out of story points, you can voluntarily be captured by the aliens.
Oh, and interesting.
The GM can give you more story points for playing along with the Doctor Who tropes, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you've got more points back for your dramatic escape and or rescue later on. And it kind of helps with things like people are always trying to help each other in the series as well, especially the companions. So if somebody's running out of story points, you've got some, you can make a rousing speech or hand them a useful gadget or something and give them story points to help them out of a situation. So that kind of balanced things out a little bit.
All right. So next problem is one shot dead, right? And
oh, yes.
In this TV series, that's great. But as a role player, you know, I don't want to, like you said, I don't want to roll up a character every session. So how do you tackle that?
Once again, that was going to be down to story points again.
Interesting.
So if you get shot, a lot of the weapons in the game don't have a damage value. They just have letter L for lethal.
Okay.
And you can spend story points to change the outcome of the dice rolls to mean that it's not quite as lethal and that you've taken a little bit of damage because you've jumped out of the way, maybe scraped your knee, banging into that wheelie bin, ducking behind it while a Dalek's shooting at you or something like that. So the story points kind of save you. So
you can almost use them like a plot armor type thing. It sounds like, right? Where I can, you know, okay, all right, that makes sense to me. And when you start playtesting this, how hard was it for the tables to grasp what you had done here? Did they immediately find it familiar, immediately understood the story point currency and how that allows them to be a companion versus a doctor? Or did it take some handholding?
Thankfully, we had some really good playtest teams, and I got emailed like masses of notes from the end of various phases of playtesting. And most people got the story point thing straight off. And you could see instantly how people were treating story points in a different way. I'd have like one game where they were like exchanging them like there was no tomorrow.
Right.
And some games where they were hoarding them thinking, oh my God, these are a precious resource. I must hold on to them. So people were approaching in completely different ways, which was great.
Did you have an intent though? Did you have an intent for the story points to be used one way versus the other? Or did you purposely leave it open so that the both play styles would work?
I think it was designed to be fairly open.
Okay.
And some of the story point costs are astronomical, but it's kind of hoping to replicate the ridiculously over-the-top things that happen in Doctor Who. For example, one of the examples we used in one of the books was the Family of Blood story, the David Tennant one. So it's almost like if you look at it from a metagaming point of view, the way that he deals with the Family of Blood, sort of imprisoning one in a star somewhere or trapping somebody in a mirror in every mirror for eternity, is not the sort of power that you give to a player character.
Right.
But you could spend that massive amount of story points to actually accomplish this by saving up story points or gaining them from doing something amazing in the park before that. And in the Doctor's case, it's almost like he sacrificed everything he had by becoming human again for a time period, which gave him a barrel load of story points plot-wise,
so cool.
Which he could spend later to deal with them.
Oh, that's so, so cool. Was there a moment for you, David, where you ended up falling back into your chair and go, I think we did this. I think we accomplished what we wanted to accomplish. Was there any feedback you got, anything that you saw once the game got out there that made you go, oh my God, like, I think we did this?
I think it was the reaction to the initiative system.
How so?
When the initiative system was designed to replicate that moment when you run into a room and there's bad guys and they're going to shoot at you and you're going to die instantly if you're not careful. And then the doctor runs in and goes, no, wait, let me talk you out of this.
Right. Which is a huge part of the doctor.
Yeah, exactly. So the initiative system means that talkers always go first.
Oh, that's cool.
In a round. Runners go second. So if you want to run away, that's fine. Which is because, let's face it, every classic story of Doctor Who, the third episode, is just running round corridors and over again. And then after that would be the doers. So if you're trying to hack into a computer or shut the doors or create a force field or something like that will save you, you go third. And then fourth and finally is anybody who wants to fight.
What an elegant way to do that, David, because by designing it that way, I'm that's very fascinating for me to think about mechanically, because you're making it mechanically clear how one should expect to play the game by giving actual advantage, ranking advantage reactions. In that, you are a clever boy. That's really cool. And it fits something that I have become a cheerleader for, which is mechanics that support play. That has become a really big thing for me because you and I talked about this briefly on the last episode. You know, I came from when I left RPGs, everything was Hero System and GURPS and everything was moving towards these generic systems. And then when I came back to a world where the focus was let's build games to tell a specific type of story. And that's exactly what you just described to me, which is we're going to make this mechanically obvious on how one should tackle to emulate this play.
Yeah. Again, it's a thing that kind of was inspired by Buffy. Mm-hmm. And it's a completely different game system for the way it works, but Buffy, when you look at it from a mechanics point of view, you can't stake the vampire until the vampire's hit points have been depleted to a certain level, and then you can stake it, which means that every time you face a vampire, you have to punch it and beat it up a bit,
right.
Which makes you feel like you're in the TV series, because that's basically all they do is they have a good punch up session with the vampires and then they stake it. And it's such a simple thing that you just look at it and go, yep, that is Buffy. And it was trying to do something that would make you think this is Doctor Who.
This is somewhat tangential, but I think it's going to accomplish what I want. You have successfully done what I've talked about, which is created a mechanic in a system that supports a very specific type of play. Mm-hmm. Is there a game that you've not been involved with that you look at as a bit of a North Star for that concept? So have you come across a game that you did not participate in where you feel it does similar to what you did with Doctor Who, right? Where you have come across something that mechanically supports a specific type of play? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. This is getting tricky because I was going to say Starship Adventures, but I was involved in that.
I greatly reduced your possible list because you can't be involved with it.
I wasn't involved for very long. It was the struggle of trying to juggle a day job and working as a line developer for Starship Adventures.
So let's use that though. What do you think in that game mechanically supports play the same way that we just talked about the initiative system?
I think it was a really nice way of using the skills that aren't skills. They're the parts that you work in on the bridge. So you have instead of having here's 20 skills, like your FASA version or something like that, you just have operations, con, medical, science. And what more do you need? That's what you're highest in. That's your division in there. That kind of replicates it perfectly. That, and I'd also mention Alien, I think, has a brilliant way of just ramping up the stress. And when you're playing, you just feel more and more tense. And every game has just brought you to complete.
It's incredible. It's so, the stress system in Alien is so good that I wonder whether Gaskin and everybody really understood how good it was, right?
Well, yes.
Like, and having played Alien a few times, like, man, oh man. And it's so mechanically ingrained in the game that you almost don't realize what's happening until it happens, which again replicates a very specific type of play, right? For the type of thing you're doing with Alien. So yeah, I can totally buy into that completely.
I'm perfectly fine. Oh no, I have to make a roll and I've got 20 dice now.
Exactly. Which normally would be great, but there's a lot of yellows in there and I'm not crazy about this at all. And I actually, the most recent play I did of that was with Anthony. And a shocker, he's a good GM. And man, there were several times where it's just like, you know, oh my God, I've got a roll right now. And I'm looking at my stress levels and all of the yellow dye in front of me and like, and right on the edge, and you build that tension right before the roll releases it. That's Alien.
It perfectly replicates that feeling of I'm too afraid to actually do anything.
Right.
Because if I do something, it's all going to go really badly wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Like this could be the last time I roll. Like this could be it. That's fantastic. So guys, we're going to take another break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about another game that I've required David to talk to me about. And that is Wild. We'll be right back.
This is Sean. You may have heard of me from such movies as Brett and Sean Go to Illinois, Two Motorcycles, One Stick of Dynamite, and Gaming and BS. What kind of RPG podcast is that? After my NFTs were stolen, I decided to become a patron of Third Floor Wars. The content is great, and it costs me less than a good shot of liquor. So consider becoming a patron. It may just land you your next big role. Head over to patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. Tell Craig Sean sent you.
So, full disclosure, Wild was another game that I'm not super familiar with. But again, as I start researching for this interview, I'm going like, why am I just now discovering what this game is? Because the hook on this one is really good as well. So let me read the blurb. Wild stands for Wake Initiated Lucid Dreaming, a real world technique for meditating into a dream while maintaining a lucid state. Within a lucid dream, you can control your actions and with practice do just about anything. The dreaming in the Wild RPG is slightly different. The technology that allows the characters to dream share makes the dream experience more coherent, logical, and most importantly, more playable as a role-playing game. So where does Wild come from? I mean, obviously we understand the, you know, lucid dreams, and I'm a very vivid dreamer. I'm one of I've discovered that there's like almost two different types of people. There's people that wake up every morning out of a dream, and I'm one of those people. It's very rare that I don't wake from a dream. My daughter is the same way. She wakes from a dream every morning, and her and I talk about this all the time. Whereas my wife very rarely wakes out of a dream. Very rarely does she remember dreaming, or is it a part of her sleep cycle? Whereas for me, it's like every night, and very often I'll wake up in the morning with multiple memories of multiple dreams, which quickly fade, which is why I keep a notebook by the bed. So this concept is interesting, but where does this start for you, David?
That's another strange one. I kind of, in context, I kind of dipped out of the RPG writing stuff. I kind of bowed back, and I made a terrible decision to try and get into writing and directing and acting in a web series.
No kidding.
Which you can't see online anymore. I'm not sure if this is a good thing or a bad thing. yeah, it was a comedy web series. We were kind of inspired by watching The Guild and things like that.
Right.
So I foolishly decided I was going to drop back and not work so hard on the Doctor Who stuff. So that kind of continued on normally. And then I went to see Inception, and I came out of Inception just like with this sort of jaw drop expression. And it just wouldn't let go. And I was kind of obsessed with it for a long time.
What is it that made it so, I mean, obviously it's an incredibly powerful movie, but what was it that wouldn't let go?
I really don't know. The visuals really got to me. And of course, off the back of that, I saw Paprika, which heavily influenced it. But yeah, I've always had a bit of a fascination with weird dream sequences in movies, and I have a distinct memory of running A Nightmare on Elm Street as a Call of Cthulhu campaign back in
Interesting.
The 80s, which was a terrible idea. But yeah, so I've always had that strange interest in weird dream stuff. I was a massive fan of Sandman, Neil Gaiman's comics. So I had the entire run as comics, and then as trades, and now as hardbacks. And love that series. I've always had a bit of a fascination with it. But so Inception just kind of ticked all the right boxes for me. And it just wouldn't let go. It was weird.
And was it just a situation, David, where you're like, I want to play in this now? I don't want to just read it. I don't want to just consume about it. I want to actually play this. So what's the next step? You've got this itch that you need to scratch. How do you start scratching it?
It's a scratch that lasted about 10 years, that one. I had the idea for it. I thought, I must write a game. I must do this. I will use the Vortex system from Doctor Who that disappeared sort of a couple of years in. Need a different game system. It doesn't quite suit. Something a bit like the really cool way that Leverage works. Mm-hmm. The RPG of Leverage is another fantastic bit of design, if ever there was one. And I kind of looked at that and started tinkering along those lines, and that wasn't quite working for me either. And then I had a strange moment of clarity. I've always been a big fan and user of tarot cards.
Oh, super interesting.
Ever since my dad had a strange interest in slightly occulty things.
Quick question before you go on, David, because there's two things possible here, and I need to know which one is true. Mm-hmm. There's two types or two groups that are fascinated by tarot cards. There are those that are fascinated by tarot cards because of the history, because of the multiple uses, the meanings and everything. And then there are those that are fascinated by tarot cards because they believe there is power in those tarot cards, right? Do you lean one way or the other?
I kind of lean towards the way that they're brilliantly designed for you to interpret them in the way you want.
Right.
I don't feel like there's a supernatural influence on them, but the design and the way that they work perfectly triggered something in your head, so that when you work out what the meaning is, you instantly feel that that's right for you.
Got it.
And that's something that's kind of resonated from me ever since my dad first bought a set. I was kind of like, well, these are, and when I'm told not to touch them, you always get that. Oh, well, there's something weird about that. And I got into art college by designing a tarot deck.
No kidding.
And so that kind of just always stuck with me. I regularly do tarot readings for myself if I'm feeling, oh, have I made the right career choice? My deck of choice is the Dave McKean Vertigo set.
So I'm not familiar with that. Why is that a favorite set of yours? What is it?
Dave McKean did all the cover art for things like Sandman and the early Hellblazers. And the deck is based on the Vertigo comics from DC. So that all the characters from Sandman, Hellblazer.
Oh my God, that's cool.
Something like that are all wacky paintings on them that he's done.
Well, so, but other than being a fan of him as an artist, is there something about that, his art being collected into a tarot deck cards that make that a more, I'm going to say powerful deck for you, but I, that's not what I mean, but I think you understand what I'm saying. A more preferred deck. Like, what is it, just the fact that you're a fan of him as an artist, or is there something else that you think's happening there by combining his art with tarot?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of that and a bit of the book that came with it. I think that the explanation for the cards and how to read them really works for me, better than any of the other books on tarot that I've read. So that kind of resonated with me. And I just had this moment of clarity where I thought, well, if you're doing a traditional Celtic cross spread to work out what's happening with your life, what is influencing you at the moment, what's happened in the past, what's going to happen in the future from what it thinks, what your immediate surroundings are like, what your innermost thoughts are, why don't you do a Celtic cross tarot deck spread to create a character?
Interesting.
And this hasn't quite made it into Wild because for reasons, but the moment I started thinking tarot deck, then the rule system came to me for Wild. So the four suits are adapted in Wild to be the four attributes you have. And the five, I say skills, they're almost like archetypes, are the court cards and the ace. So when you're making a roll, instead of it being a roll, you're drawing three tarot cards like you would do with a three-card spread.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of those are above the value of your attribute or skill, then you get a success. If the suit matches the suit that you use, the attribute that you're using, you get another success. And if you get a court card that matches the skill you're using, you get another success.
So
you
can, that's cool.
Escalate it up like that. And also, not only are you basically just using the numbers and the suits from the cards, but you can each card also has their simplified meaning printed on them. So that if you get a super good success, you look at the meaning of the card and see how that you can interpret that into your success or into your failure. So it's taking away just being the analog success, right, fail, almost a bit like the Fantasy Flight Star Wars did.
The narrative dice. Yeah.
So it was kind of drawn from that.
Mechanically super interesting, but the other thing that kind of I found interesting too is this idea of a dream technology. And I want to get a sense of, when was that in the very beginning as you started to kind of build this world in your head? Did you realize that in order to take this to the next level, we needed to add technology? Like, when did the dream technology become a part of the game?
Probably straight away from coming out of Inception. I knew it had to be something that allowed people to connect very easily, and then along came a backstory, which started up off as a NaNoWriMo novel, which I wrote one frantic November. I just thought, I know, I will write the whole backstory in a month because it would be great, and produce it as a first part of a trilogy of novels, which I haven't developed any further. But I managed to finish the first book, not entirely happy with it, but it did set up the basic story of a tech designer whose daughter slips into a coma and he uses the technology to try and wake her up. And that's the default for the solo play.
Interesting. So
you're trying to wake up this character from being in her trapped dream state of running around her old school and her old environment, things like that. And that's what's... Because each suit of a tarot deck, as you go through the cards, they have a narrative. And so each suit of the deck that was designed for Wild, which was illustrated by an old friend of mine, Gareth Slightholm, each suit follows the narrative of one of the characters from the backstory. And along those lines.
Very, very cool. So the last thing that I always like to do with creators, and you and Anthony did this back on episode 206, is I like to find out what you've been grooving on lately. So is there anything recently that you have played, read, watched that got its hooks into you?
Currently playing Aegean, which is it's supposed to be mythic ancient Greece. which was written by Stu Goff, who is a friend of mine that from that old Mage witchcraft game, who was the guy who came up to me about 2 or 3 years ago and said, look, you've been working on Wild for 10 years now. Isn't it about time you kickstarted it? I will help. So basically, he's the one that's published Wild for me. So we've been playing that, but not playing it as ancient Greece. We've been playing it as mythic Vikings.
Interesting. So why, when was that decision made and why?
I don't know. I think Stu just really wants to play some Vikings with zombies in it.
Phenomenal.
So it's just a bit, it's epic and really cool. And the game system works really well. I think we were having, it was a bit of a reaction to our one worrying game that we just finished where we had about 4 total party kills. We're just not going to survive long enough for this. Let's try something else.
What's clicking for you other than the contrast to the previous game?
It's just nice that you're, while it's Vikings and we've watched the TV series and we love the series.
Good series.
It's got a little bit more of a weird supernatural element to it. So it's not quite so, hey, we're going to come and pillage and stuff like that. We're actually, as I say, we're currently facing hordes of zombies, which is all tied into some mythology going on there as well, which is great.
Running the game, David?
Stu's running that one.
Yeah.
I haven't GM'd for, I'm going to say about 8 or 9 years now.
Do you miss
it? Yeah. I've got this strange urge to get back to it. But
what do you miss about running a game versus playing?
Oh, just that God complex, isn't it? complete control.
So I guess the next question I'll ask then is, future David returns to GMing. Mm-hmm. Is there a system out there that you think would be able to pull you back in? Is there something you've had your left eye on that you've just looked at and that could be the game that you run when you kind of take the dust off the GM cloak?
That's tricky. There's a couple. At the back of my head, I keep thinking, I really want to run Masks of Nyarlathotep. Which is a bit of a huge commitment considering
it is.
Like my brain space is kind of taken up with work. But I do particularly love Tales from the Loop.
It's so cool.
That has been easily my favorite game in the last 10 years. It's just
really
just, yeah.
Why?
There's just something so freaking simple about it. It was mm-hmm. sort of, when you're looking at that core rule book and you think the rules are only 18 pages or something like that, that's all you need. It's just lovely. We had such another campaign that Stu ran. We played an epic Tales from the Loop game that lasted so long that our characters grew up into teens. So we moved over to Things from the Flood.
Yep.
And then we failed to stop whatever was happening at the loop and ended up in post-apocalyptic mutant year zero.
Oh my goodness. You guys. Oh, that's a cool idea.
And then we managed to time travel our mutated selves back to the 80s, back to Tales from the Loop to try and stop it all from happening again. It was a game that lasted about, I don't know, nearly a year. And it was phenomenal.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And the whole time staying within year zero. So mechanically things were able to transpose through that. That's absolutely fascinating. Well, David, I mean, one of the things that happened after we did the RPG a day episode is I immediately said, like, I need to get you back on because we've got a lot to talk about. And quite frankly, I mean, me enjoying having Anthony on the show is nothing new. You know, having an opportunity to meet you and spend time with you, I just knew that I needed to spend more time with you. So there's a lot of really cool things to do on a Saturday afternoon that doesn't involve talking to me. So I appreciate you making the time.
No problem at all. No, it's great fun. Anytime.
And for those of you listening, you made it. This is the end. All the way through. I appreciate you doing that too. Take care.
Thanks a ton for tuning in to another fantastic episode of Tabletop Talk, and a big shout out to David for joining me today. You can find out more about his work on cubicle7games.com. Who is your favorite doctor? Do you love the original run or the most recent doctors? I'm dying to hear your thoughts. Let me know on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, or even drop me a line at admin@thirdfloorwars.com. And don't worry, all those links are in the show notes. You are the heartbeat of this podcast. Without your support, patronage, and listenership, I wouldn't have had this incredible conversation. In a world dominated by quick clips, shorts, reels, and snippets, it's terrific to know that folks like you still exist and crave deep, meaningful discussions. If you've got a second and you're not behind the wheel, would you do me a solid and hit that subscribe button or leave a rating? I bet one of your pals would dig this episode too. Why not share it with them? Last thing, you don't want to miss the next episode. Now, David mentioned Stu Goff. The next episode is me talking with Stu about his creative process for making game favorites like The Gaslight Club and The GN. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it. Happy gaming, friends. You know that thing you've been thinking about? You've been churning it around in your brain space? Today's a good day to make it. Go create. God, I love talking to you, David.
No worries at all. That's great.
Yeah, I just realized like I literally could do this for 2 hours with you. Oh. All right, I'll bring us back. Oh, perfect, perfect.
Cool. Oh boy.
You're right.
This might be this. Yeah, I was just going to say this might be a struggle. I haven't thought about Wild for a while now. Well, it's one of those things that's out.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be super long. I just it reads as very unique for me, so I'm probably just going to dig into that aspect of it. So by means does this need to be a 30-minute segment. Okay,
no worries.
Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and yeah, get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care. Bye.